Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Brian Lynn. Later, we bring you the latest in the American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report.
With more than 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States, it may seem like students have plenty of access to higher education, but that is not always the case for students from places like Central Colorado or Western Texas, for example. For high school students in rural areas, even going on a college visit may be difficult. That is part of why most colleges and universities employ officials known as recruiters. These people travel around the country to meet with students and bring them important information related to higher education. College recruiters may visit individual high schools or plan larger events where students from a wider area can speak with them. Many even travel to high schools outside the United States to attract international students. Recruiters help colleges and universities better identify the kinds of students they are looking to admit and stay in contact with them, says Ozan Jaquet. He is an assistant professor of education at the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA. Jaquet says recruiting also usually means more students will apply to the school. And students who meet with a recruiter may be more likely to choose to go to that school if they are admitted.
This is a way of developing a stronger bond with students so they feel a sense of warmth about the university. Because, hey, this person from this university came and wanted to speak to me, he told VOA. And it's also kind of a means of a higher touch sales pitch. This deeper connection means a lot to underrepresented groups, like students who would be the first from their family to attend college. There are many possible first-generation college students in rural areas, Jaquet notes. He says those students are more likely to be unsure of whether they would fit in at a university. Yet, Jaquet and other researchers recently published a study suggesting that college recruiters are not actually visiting many rural communities. In fact, the study suggests few recruiters are meeting with students who may need their help the most. The researchers announced their findings through an opinion piece in the New York Times newspaper earlier this month. They looked at the recruiting efforts of about 150 U.S. colleges and universities in 2017. They found that recruiters at private colleges made about half their visits to high schools in areas where households make more than $100,000 a year on average. Only about one-third of American households make that much money. Also, private college recruiters mostly visited private high schools, which most often serve students from wealthy families.
The researchers also took a close look at 15 public colleges and universities. They found that at 12 of those schools, recruiters made more visits outside of the college's home state than within it. And most of those out-of-state trips were to wealthy, majority white, suburban high schools, schools just outside of cities. Jaquette says such recruiting plans work against the main purpose of public higher education, which is to serve all kinds of students in a school's home state first. Some school officials have argued that it can be especially costly to visit rural schools, where recruiters may only speak with a few students. Also, states have greatly reduced their financial support for public higher education over the last 20 years. This means the schools depend more on tuition payments from students to cover operating costs. Out-of-state tuition costs are much higher than in-state fees. And wealthy out-of-state students require less financial assistance from the schools. So out-of-state and international students have become much more attractive to recruiters. Faye Huey says this has an effect on rural communities. It may limit rural students' abilities to succeed after high school. Huey is a researcher at the National Student Clearinghouse, an organization that supports American higher education.
Huey helps produce a yearly report that gathers data on American high school students. Her group's 2018 report showed that students from both rural and urban high schools were 4% less likely to go to college right after graduating than students from suburban schools. Jamie Anthony is an admissions official at Carleton College. The school is in a small town about 1 hour outside the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. Anthony says the school has actively taken steps to build relationships with rural high schools in the area. A lot of times it comes down to access to information, she said. And because there's not many given students at a given school, there's not a lot of different examples of what the path after high school can look like. In 2012, Carleton established the Herb and Barbara Fritch Scholarship, which aims to offer financial support to middle-class students from rural areas and smaller cities. The year before the scholarship was launched, about 8% of Carleton's students came from rural areas. Now it is closer to 12%. Carleton is not the only school to make such efforts. The University of Chicago recently launched a summer program designed for rural students. UCLA's Ozan Jaquette says more schools should be doing the same. He noted that military and for-profit college recruiters seem to have no problem reaching rural high school students. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Today, a different kind of words and their stories. An examination of the word redaction. This week, United States Attorney General William Barr released the long-awaited report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. The report presents the findings of Mueller's investigation into possible collusion between the presidential campaign of Donald Trump and Russia. It also aimed to answer whether Trump tried to obstruct justice during the investigation. The 400-page report, however, includes redactions. And Congress is prepared to fight the administration to get a complete, unredacted report released to the public. Dictionary publisher Merriam-Webster defines the verb redact as to select or adapt, as by removing sensitive information, for publication or release. The publisher said searches for the words redact, redacted, and redaction increased 4,000% on March 29th. The rise in searches followed Barr's letter to Congress on the Mueller report. In the letter, Barr wrote that he was preparing the report for release, making the redactions that are required. Barr said the redactions are needed to protect grand jury material, classified intelligence, ongoing investigations, and the privacy rights of others. The U.S. government has redacted things from the most sensitive information to the most harmless facts throughout history. Tom Blanton is with the National Security Archive, an organization that calls for open government. He told the Associated Press, "We believe there are real secrets, common sense secrets, like names of people in the field who would be killed or specifications of weapons of systems." Blanton added, "But redactions are also overused." Blanton noted that the U.S. government redacted information on intelligence files for Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, who was accused of human rights abuses. In 2003, the Defense Intelligence Agency released documents that included Pinochet's life story. Some information, however, was redacted for national security. Blanton found out that the redacted information included Pinochet's favorite alcoholic drinks. David Cole is legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He said any government official with a security clearance would want to redact some information. Cole said, "If you make a mistake and disclose something you shouldn't have, that mistake is public. If you decide to keep something secret that doesn't need to be secret, that mistake is private." The need for redaction is as old as the country itself. In 1787, America's founding fathers met in Pennsylvania to draft the nation's constitution behind closed doors. They wanted to speak freely and keep some information from the public. No official papers were kept on the debate, so there was nothing to redact. And James Madison's personal notes of the meeting did not come out until 1836, after Madison and other delegates were dead. "I think they are pretty reliable," historian Gordon Wood said of Madison's notes. "But they may only account for a fraction of what was said at the convention." At the end of World War II, the U.S. became a superpower. The amount of redacted documents grew with the establishment of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council. Tim Weiner wrote Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. He said, "In 1947, when you have creation of the CIA and the NSC, you have the production of literally billions of papers and billions of secrets contained within them. In the years since, U.S. intelligence and other agencies have redacted some unlikely information from the public. The list includes a method for opening sealed letters without detection and a formula for secret ink from Germany during World War I. The information was redacted until 2011. The redaction in 2014 of remarks about the Cuban Missile Crisis made by Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. The remarks were made 50 years earlier in a public speech. FBI files about actor Marilyn Monroe's reported communist sympathies were redacted in 2012, 50 years after her death. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson and American involvement in World War I.
'18 was the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. But World War I did not end quickly or easily. The German army made a final effort to defeat the Allies. The United States had entered the conflict, and Germany wanted a victory before large numbers of American troops could get to Europe. Germany's effort became easier after it signed a peace treaty with the new Bolshevik government in Russia. The treaty made it possible for Germany to use all its forces against the Allies on its western border. In the end, however, Germany's plan failed. Allied troops pushed back the German attack in a series of bloody battles. The addition of American soldiers greatly increased Allied strength.
The leader of American forces in Europe was General John J. Pershing. General Pershing used a weapon new to the world of war, air power. Airplanes were used first, simply as eyes in the sky. They discovered enemy positions so ground artillery could fire at them. Then they were used as fighter planes. They carried guns to shoot down other planes. Finally, planes were built big enough to carry bombs. General Pershing also used another new weapon of war, tanks. He put these inventions together for his battle plan against Germany.
Pershing's target was the Argonne Forest. It was a tree-covered area Germany had held since 1914. The forest was protected by barbed wire and by defensive positions built of steel and concrete. It was the strongest part of the German line. It also was the most important part. If Argonne fell, Germany's final lines of defense would fall. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was fierce. Thousands of men died. Sometimes troops got lost because the forest was so thick with trees. But day by day, the Allies pushed the Germans back.
Mm-hmm.
Germany's leaders were losing hope. In September 1918, they met with German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm. The army chief reported that the war was lost. Germany had no choice, he said. It must give back all the territory it had seized and try to negotiate a peace agreement. Other officials told the Kaiser that the situation at home was bad, too. People were starving. Revolutionaries were plotting to overthrow the government. Kaiser Wilhelm agreed it might be best to seek peace now, before Germany was destroyed completely. He asked his foreign secretary to send a secret message to American President Woodrow Wilson. The message would propose immediate negotiations to end the war.
President Wilson received it. He did not tell the other Allied leaders. Instead, he returned a message to Germany. Wilson asked if Germany was willing to accept the peace proposals he had offered many months earlier. Germany's chancellor answered that his government did accept the proposals. However, the events of war ended the secret exchange of messages between Germany and the United States. German submarines had increased attacks on Allied shipping. 2 passenger ships were sunk. 820 persons were killed. Many were women and children. President Wilson was shocked. He told Germany there could be no peace negotiations with such an inhuman enemy.
In late October 1918, Wilson sent a final message to Germany. He wanted a settlement that would make it impossible for Germany to fight again. Germany, Wilson said, must promise to withdraw its forces from all Allied territory. It also must close its weapons factories. Wilson added that the Allies would negotiate only with a government that truly represented the people of Germany, not with military rulers. The new German chancellor was Maximilian, Prince of Baden. Prince Max received President Wilson's message. He succeeded in getting Kaiser Wilhelm to dismiss the man responsible for German military policy. But he failed to get the Kaiser himself to give up power.
Not all Allied leaders supported President Wilson's plan to end World War I. They could not agree on some parts of it. Britain, for example, opposed the part about freedom of the seas. Britain said it would prevent the kind of naval blockade which had been so effective against Germany. France and Italy opposed the part about creating a new international organization. Wilson had called it a League of Nations. To solve these differences, Wilson sent his closest advisor to Europe to meet with Allied leaders. The discussions were long and sometimes bitter. Many of the Allies thought Wilson was being too kind to the defeated enemy. But in the end, they all agreed to accept the plan as a starting point for peace talks.
By this time, in early November, the situation in Germany was growing worse. Communists and socialists were calling for a rebellion. The Navy was ordered to go to sea. sailors refused and killed some officers. Reports told of rebellion in parts of the German army, too. The nation's leaders had no choice. They would negotiate a peace treaty. On the morning of November 8th, a German delegation went to Allied military headquarters to discuss terms.
The Germans were met by the Supreme Allied Commander, Marshal Ferdinand Foch of France. Foch greeted them coldly, and he did not offer peace terms until they officially asked for a ceasefire. Germany, not the Allies, had to put down its weapons first. The Germans were shocked when they heard the terms. The list was severe. Among other things, Germany must withdraw its forces from all occupied territories. It must give up Alsace-Lorraine, a part of France it had held for almost 50 years. It must give up most of its weapons, including airplanes, submarines, and battleships. And it must turn over large numbers of trucks, railroad engines, and other supplies.
The German delegation said it could not sign such an agreement. Germany, it said, was not surrendering. It was only asking for a ceasefire. The delegation said it could not accept the peace terms without communicating with the government in Berlin. But the German government was falling apart. Kaiser Wilhelm had finally resigned and left the country. A new cabinet had been formed, and a new prime minister had declared a German republic. Yet the situation remained unsettled. Because of this, the German delegation negotiating with the Allies had to decide for itself. After much argument, the men agreed to the Allied terms. They signed the peace treaty. A ceasefire began a few hours later.
News that the shooting had stopped set off wild celebrations throughout the world. People danced in the streets. They cheered the end of the worst war in history. There were celebrations along the battle lines, too. But these were quiet. Soldiers from both sides climbed out of long trenches dug in the ground. They met the men who, a short while earlier, had been their deadly enemy. The bloody European conflict was over. The dispute, however, was not. Another fierce battle was ready to begin. This time, the battle would be among diplomats. The fight over the peace treaty, officially ending World War I, was about to begin.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.